Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. At the risk of oversimplifying just a bit, you can't spell economy on this Friday without the letters G, D, and P. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, April the 26th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. G is for gross, D is for domestic, P is for product, defined as the value of all the goods and services produced in this economy. It's right up there at the top of the list of economic indicators, though not without some flaws, which we will get to in a bit. But I mention it because we got what is known as the advanced estimate, in essence, the rough draft of GDP growth for the first quarter of the year this morning, up 3.2%. Upside surprise is the word you're looking for there. And it is the place we will begin our discussion of the week that was in this economy. Here to do that with us are Catherine Rempel from The Washington Post, also Sudeep Reddy from Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. Upside surprise, and with the caveat that we are going to do a little dissection of this thing in about 5-6 minutes with Nancy Marshall Genzer, what's your gut telling you about this number?
Well, the headline number looks good, certainly better than was predicted. The underlying guts of the number, in terms of like the components of it that are a little more forward-looking, which I'm guessing you're going to get to more in depth later.
So not the guts of the number, but your guts, right? I mean, you know,
both of our guts. Guts all around. In the sense that, like, the consumption number was disappointing, the business investment number also disappointing, and the main mechanism through which we were told that the Trump tax cuts were going to boost the economy from here until eternity was, of course, in business investment. And the fact that both of those components of it were a little disappointing is not encouraging. That said, like, there's no suggestion that there's going to be a recession around the corner, which had been the fear not that long ago.
Right. Speaking of recession, and again, not that we're saying that, Sudeep, but the rest of the world is not looking great, right? I mean, Europe's in trouble and the Chinese, you never know. Australia, for crying out loud, is slowing down faster than anybody else in that part of the world. We now are leading the global economy. Is that what's happening?
Today, others in the world are looking at us and wishing they were us. If you go back 3 or 4 months, though, there were a lot of people watching a ridiculous 35-day government shutdown. Mm-hmm. They were watching the markets just tumble as a result of the Fed modestly raising interest rates. They were watching the U.S. squabbling about tariffs. It doesn't always look as good. But just today, we can say that the U.S. economy, it survived and maybe even thrived through all of these pressures, these disruptions from the public sector and the private sector showing momentum and the ability to power through it. We've seen this before with chaos, but the ability to maintain that momentum, it just means that the recession is not going to come from old age for the expansion is it's going to come from something else.
Something else is going to happen. Catherine, I want to, since you mentioned it, I want to turn really briefly to the Federal Reserve. Larry Kudlow, the president's chief economic advisor, came out today, as he is wont to do on days of good economic numbers, and which is his right. And he said what he thinks, with the economy growing at 3.2% and an annualized rate in this quarter, what we really ought to do is have the Federal Reserve cut interest rates. Explain why you think he's saying that.
Well, so there is some tension between those two claims, right? It's like the economy's going gangbusters, but the Fed really needs to stimulate the economy. I just want to step back for a moment and remind everyone how bonkers it is that someone of his level in the executive branch is commenting on Fed policy at all, by the way, because for decades we have had a norm that no one in the executive branch talks about interest rates to preserve both the practice and perception of central bank independence. So that in and of itself remains inappropriate and risky. But why does he want to cut rates? You know, he's traditionally a hard money guy, because presumably it will help Trump's reelection chances. So I think that's how you square that circle. Mm-hmm.
Sudeep, also equally briefly, I want to touch on Stephen Moore, the president's not officially a nominee, but a guy whose name he has blurted out more than once he would like to see on the Federal Reserve. Mr. Moore, as you and Catherine and I were talking about before we turned the microphones on, seems to be doing a whole lot of press, as it were, for a man who's possibly going to be on the Federal Reserve Board. Do you suppose his chances are as good now as they were a week and a half ago, maybe?
Well, what Trump nominees and officials have learned is that it's very wise, if you want to win over the president, to get out on the airwaves, especially get on television, make a lot of noise, show that you're a good brand, maybe raise your value in the market. He's doing all of that. He's probably losing a lot of the Senate as he does that. If he had enough to get by in a confirmation, he's probably losing more of that as each day passes.
Only has to lose four, right?
So. Only has to lose four. Yeah. But, you know, I don't see it as likely that this will be the nominee who ends up coming in and shaking up up the Fed. But it's entertaining. And that's what Trump world is about at the moment. Entertaining.
Wow. A word here about an article, Sudeep, that appeared in Politico today that you edited. Ben White, who does Morning Money, and Victoria Guida had a piece on basically, if Trump could stay on message and the economy stays solid, 2020 looks very good for him, but he can't stay on message. Talk to me about that piece and Ben's take on that.
The president of the United States is living in a dream scenario right now. He has growth strengthening. He has wages rising. He has unemployment falling. He's got markets rocketing to new highs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is a dream. This is the thing you should be going out and talking about every day. You should be building confidence among businesses to get even stronger hiring. You should be doing all of that. And there's a split screen life we're going through right now where he's trying to do some of that, but he's got the Mueller thing hanging over him and still quite a bit of anger about the 2016 election and all of these things that just aren't quite there. So if he could maintain this, it's 18 months to the election. There's a long way to go, both for the economy and for the president. But he's going to come now into a period in a few months where he can say that I am overseeing the longest expansion in American history. And that is what a president would love to have to get reelected. And we don't really see that message quite as much right now.
Catherine, spitball it for me. And I mean, like in 15 seconds, do you think the economy is an issue in 2020 or have we all forgotten about it by then and we moved on to something else as we are wont to do?
If it's good, it's not an issue, right? It can only help Trump.
Yeah.
If it's bad, and about half of economists surveyed by The Wall Street Journal said that they expect a recession next year. I don't know if it'll happen or not, but if it's bad, it could be an issue because presidents, rightly or wrongly, are held responsible for the state of the economy, even if they're not actually controlling it.
Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, Sudeep Reddy at Politico on this Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
On Wall Street, some new record highs, as Sudeep was saying, courtesy of that GDP number. We will have the details when we do the numbers. So, GDP and, as Catherine and I danced around a little bit, the fine print, the numbers that went into that 3.2% growth number, if you will, this morning, some of them were pretty unexpected, the innards, the guts. In a good way, yes, but also in a temporary way, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
I'm going to start this story by taking the advice of Bank of America economist Ethan Harris.
I think it's important when you get numbers like this to kind of stand back and do a little bit of a smell check on things.
Let's begin with trade. Surging exports of autos and food and falling imports contributed a full percentage point to GDP growth. Those strong export numbers offset weaker consumer spending, but they're not expected to last because Harris says U.S. manufacturers were just trying to get ahead of the next volley in the trade war.
Sell products before new rounds of tariffs come in.
Something else juicing GDP? Inventories. U.S. businesses have been stocking up, expecting consumers to keep up their spending. Beth Ann Bovino is U.S. chief economist at S&P Global. She says those manufacturers and retailers need to unload their inventories before they restock or make more.
If they don't sell, then that means that inventories won't be a contributor going forward, and that could be a drag later on.
Still, economists say the U.S. economy will keep growing, even without these temporary boosts. Lydia Boussour is senior U.S. economist at Oxford Economics.
So the economy remains on solid footing, although it is slowing.
Boussour expects GDP to grow a little more than 2% this year, a far cry from this quarter's 3.2%, barring any big surprises, that is. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Amazon reported quarterly profits yesterday, a record $3.5 billion January through March, because basically it has become the go-to place to buy almost anything and get it in 2 days for free, provided, of course, you pony up $119 a year for Amazon Prime. Walmart and Target and all the rest, though, have gotten into that game, free two-day shipping and no membership fees. So, Amazon's next trick? Go to the head of the class. Yes, 1 day free shipping. It's going to take a pile of cash to make that happen, though. But Bezos and company are guessing it's going to be worth it. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
$800 million. That's how much Amazon will shell out in just this quarter to, quote, evolve toward 1 day free shipping. And those costs may rise, predicts analyst Tuna Amobi at CFRA Research. He says a big expense is that last step in the transport chain, when Amazon's local partners bring that box of top-selling chocolate truffles to your doorstep.
This is something that will require the collaboration with their transportation partners like FedEx and UPS and United States Postal Service.
Still, many analysts think Amazon will make its money back in bigger orders of, say, the top-selling drinking card game, Buzzed. Studies find the faster something ships, the more we buy. The fancy term for that is shipping elasticity, says business professor Aninda Ghosh at NYU's Stern School of Business.
Look, if you reduce it from 2 days to 1 day, we are going to more than double the volume.
He expects this to lure not just more buyers, but more third-party sellers on Amazon.com. Now, one-day shipping will take more trucks, driving more often, says transport scholar Genevieve Giuliano at the University of Southern California. She says that'll cost the environment, which means free overnight shipping is not really free when you pay $18.98 for those top-selling yoga pants.
But it's also the price of what it's costing in terms of greenhouse gases and everything else.
As one-day free shipping phases in, expect the typical Prime member to spend more. Right now, that person spends $1,400 a year on the site. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There was a report out from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York a couple of weeks ago that is both timely and alarming. There is, and this figure is from the end of 2018, there is $1.46 trillion worth of student debt in this economy. Alarming because $1.5 trillion, hello. Timely because we're getting to that time of year when a whole new chunk of college graduates is going to have to start paying down their student loans. And for those college seniors, degree in hand and hopefully with a job, there is also a whole bunch of worry about their financial futures. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman talked with two soon-to-be graduates in some very different circumstances.
The private liberal arts school Whitman College is where 22-year-old Rachel Glover has racked up $30,000 in debt. That's about average for college grads who take out federal student loans.
It's funny because I try to avoid thinking about this as much as I possibly can, just because it's stressful.
The environmental studies major is sitting on Whitman's sweeping green lawn on a windy day in Walla Walla, Washington, surrounded by students throwing frisbees, hanging out, and studying. This year, tuition, room, and board at Whitman is $66,000. Glover grew up in Portland, Maine, where her dad works in insurance, her mom at a grocery store.
I have a combination of financial aid, scholarships, and loans. Even after that, my parents are helping pay for, like, the remainder.
She could have done college a lot cheaper.
I considered moving back home and going to state school where I could have gone for almost for free.
But something held her back from transferring.
I believed in the idea that going to a small private school would help me in a way that a state school wouldn't.
You put it in past tense. I believed. Do you still?
I definitely hope it. But the flip side of that hope is the terrible fear that I've just put myself in thousands of dollars of debt and given myself no real advantage.
She's afraid what she's given herself is a huge financial mountain to climb with no clear idea how she's going to scale it. She'll stick around in Walla Walla this summer to finish her senior thesis, but after that, she doesn't have a job lined up, isn't sure what career she wants to pursue.
A huge thing that the debt has done is made it feel inconceivable, almost, that I will be able to buy a home. Or having kids, or even really buying a car. Just rent and groceries is hard enough.
Borrowing for college can lead to buyer's remorse.
So financial aid is independent as long as
Sabrina Hayes is at a college fair in Portland, Oregon, where she's filling out financial aid forms to transfer to Portland State University. The 41-year-old mother of twins started at a local community college when her kids were infants, and she's been taking classes for 5 years already. She wishes she'd known how much debt she'd be taking on.
I think when it's all said and done, because I'm a single mom, it's taking me longer. A 4-year degree is going to end up costing me close to $80,000.
She's borrowed $50,000 so far. And even though finishing her BA program in human resources is still a ways off, she's worried.
It's terrifying. You hear these stories that there's no guarantee that you're going to get a job. I'm so far in, though, that I don't want to quit and have all this debt on my back.
Do you regret having started on this path?
Absolutely. I would have sought going into this career first before going to school for it.
But she also didn't think she could reach her financial life goals working in restaurants and social service jobs like she did before going to college. She's hoping eventually to buy a house, but her student loans are in the way.
It's overwhelming how much I'm going to have to pay a month. I mean, you have this idea that you're going to keep it under control, but it's almost like a credit card. You just keep going and going.
Hayes is hoping once she graduates to earn enough to pay down her student loans before her twin daughters, now 5, start racking up college debt of their own. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, the first building where everybody meets is the dance hall, and it's used not just for dances.
Grab your partner and do-si-do. Actually, it'll be the Texas two-step, but whatevs. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 81 points. It's Friday, 0.3%, 26,543. NASDAQ gained 27 points, also 0.3%, 81.46. The S&P 500 found itself 13 points to the good, 0.4%, 29.39 there. For the week, the Dow unchanged, the NASDAQ up 1.8%, the S&P 500 up 1.2%. Ford Motor revved up 10.7% today after turning in first quarter results that investors liked. Big drop for Intel, the chipmaker lost 8.9% today. Target down 5.5%, 5.6% actually. Walmart down 1.9% after Amazon, as Scott Tong was telling us, said it's going to make one-day shipping standard for Prime. Amazon gained 2.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I want you to listen to this week's Make Me Smart. We're talking about Medicare for All, a not-so-mainstream idea just a couple of years ago. It is now moving, though, front and center in the political conversation. So what might it look like?
Once you say Medicare for All is coming, once you tell insurers, like, your industry is ending, you might have this very quick collapse. But it's a big unknown. You know, I can't tell you what happens when you and the private insurance company, because we haven't really tried anything like that.
Make Me Smart. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hey, you heard about the big world premiere today, right? Yeah, no, not that one. We did superheroes yesterday. We're talking now about Taylor Swift. She's got a new video and single out. It's called Me. It's all caps with an exclamation point, of course. Before she dropped it, at midnight, she dropped a ton of hints on social media and worked some of her fans into breathless states of anticipation. It is state-of-the-art music marketing, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports for the YouTube era.
I happened to be awake at midnight, so I tuned in to the world premiere of Taylor Swift's new music video. And my, was it spectacular. It was like peering inside the mind of a unicorn. There were rainbows, kittens, butterflies, hearts. When was the last time you watched a pop single premiere live? Maybe it was the 90s or 2000s? Ray Roa remembers those days. He's the music director at an alt weekly called Creative Loafing Tampa. And he used to rush home from school to watch artists drop their new singles and videos on MTV.
Whether I was going to admit it to my friends or not, I was watching NSYNC, Britney Spears. I mean, it was all about who was going to be on the show waving at the window.
In other words, it was appointment television. And that's exactly what Taylor Swift achieved with the premiere of her new song on YouTube. She built up to it with a countdown clock and hints on Instagram. Jeff Rabhan is a music business professor at NYU. And he says Swift cut through the clutter that is social media.
You're creating an event, and you're creating a galvanizing event where, you know, your entire fan base can all sort of, you know, be there together.
Swift used a feature that YouTube launched last year called YouTube Premieres. Ariana Grande used it for her video Thank You Next last fall. YouTube says almost a million fans tuned in. Her video now has more than 360 million views. Since midnight, Taylor Swift's has racked up almost 30 million. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
There's an architectural preservation thing going on out in some parts of rural Texas. People are trying to save historic dance halls built usually around the turn of the last century. Immigrant German and Czech farming communities used them. They're kind of barn-like, these buildings are. They were used for dances or parties or just to hash out community business sometimes. But with changing traditions and musical tastes as well, saving those buildings is an uphill economic fight. From the Marketplace Hub at Houston Public Media, Travis Bubenik has that story.
This is the kind of music you might have heard at a dance hall in the early 1900s. It's a song recorded in 1929 by Texas Czech Orchestra Bacheva Česká Kapela. Historian and Texas music expert Joe Nick Potosky says dance halls weren't just for music. They were also like a town square.
The first building where everybody meets is the dance hall, and it's used not just for dances, but it's used for social functions. It's when the community meets and wants to discuss affairs. They all meet at the dance hall.
Through the years, traditional waltzes and polkas morphed into Western swing and country music. And eventually, the dance of choice became the boot scootin' Texas two-step. Bobby Flores and the Yellow Rose Band at a historic hall in Goliad, Texas last year. Potosky says the participatory experience of a dance hall is what draws people.
After the song's over, people aren't applauding and cheering. They're catching their breath and they're going back to their seat so they can get another beer and get rested up for the next song.
There's been renewed interest in these halls in recent years. They can hold hundreds of people, so some have been renovated and turned into modern music venues with professional sound systems. Others, like La Bahia Turnverein, strive for a more traditional feel, but pull in money through wedding rentals. Roy Schmidt rolls open a heavy wooden door into La Bahia.
I was born and raised in here. My parents, my grandfathers, everybody put this here before me. And so that's when I just fell in line.
There's a minimalist beauty to the place. White-walled exterior, smooth wooden dance floor, drop-down windows that let the country breeze in. A nonprofit Schmidt leads owns the hall. He says the group was broke just a few years ago, but now has $40,000 or $50,000 in the bank, mostly thanks to rentals for things like weddings.
And we get them all the way from Atlanta to California to all over the country. It's all word of mouth. I mean, basically, they came through here. They wanted their friends, got married here.
Still, that business has limits. There's only so much you can charge for an old, non-air-conditioned building in Texas. And then there's the upkeep.
you know, they're old buildings. They take a lot of maintenance.
Deb Fleming heads up a group called Texas Dance Hall Preservation, which has counted more than 100 historic halls across the state. The group helps halls come up with new business models and promote events. The group also distributes grants for preservation work. It's got about $30,000 on hand for that this year. Fleming says there's not one way to save a hall.
It's a matter of what makes the best sense at the time and being open to the possibilities of change.
Down the road, John Perez unlocks the door to Round Top Dance Hall, another historic building that's taking a for-profit approach. Perez says he's basically breaking even. Round Top also hosts weddings and the occasional live band, but Perez pulls in money from a restaurant and bar next door as well. He says a big challenge is that it's getting more expensive to throw a dance.
The price of entertainment and entertainers are skyrocketing. To try to, you know, pay what the musicians are due, your insurances and everything like that, it's tough.
Deb Fleming says a broader cultural shift is key to saving the halls.
If the next generation doesn't step up to really engage with these kind of places, these places are going to die a slow death, because many of the halls that are nonprofit or community halls are basically managed and maintained by people in their 70s and 80s.
Texas lawmakers are considering legislation that could help. It would let small music venues apply to get a cut of the money back from alcohol sales taxes. In Houston, I'm Travis Bubinick for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a public service announcement of sorts with the new Avengers movie now open wide across the country. The thing runs 3 hours and 2 minutes, which is a long time, especially if you have one of those big giant sodas. And maybe all y'all already knew this, but there are websites out there that will tell you when it's safe, plot-wise, to go to the bathroom. Look it up. You'll thank me later. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's up 81 today, 0.3%. NASDAQ up 27, also 0.3%. S&P 500 found 13 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you again on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.